Welcome back to a new episode of Geeks at College. I am your host, Taylor. I'm joined by Casey.
As always, sometimes, most of the time.
As for 98% of the time.
More times than I would care to mention.
God, I hate you.
That's it. We're breaking up, and I'll be the Paul Simon to your Art Garfunkel.
Bridge over troubled water.
Hey, want me to tell you about my new podcast, Graceland? I recorded it with my black friends.
My black friends. I want Danny DeVito to play Paul Simon in a movie.
Why would you get someone taller than Paul Simon to play him, though?
Well, because there's not a lot of options, I'm just saying.
I personally think that they would have to take Danny DeVito, but they would have to do Lord of the Rings technology in order to get him to look Paul Simon.
They have to have everyone else just stand on boxes.
And he has to stand 4 feet further away while still looking up and matching the eye line.
Yes.
And sometimes they'll just CG him in. You know, like what they did with Tom Cruise in every Tom Cruise movie.
Yep. Where Tom Cruise is actually 2 inches tall.
And for your permission, Tom Cruise was a stunt double for everybody in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
And he was also the lead in The Indian in the Cupboard. So, which should be called the Native American in the Cupboard, just to be...
Same. Well, actually, in The Indian in the Cupboard, he had to stand on a box in order to get to right height.
Anyway,
he once got lost in the camera, and they couldn't get him out.
As we did last week, we recapped the new episode of Doctor Who. Last week, we talked about Deep Breath, Peter Capaldi's, I guess, inaugural episode, we could call it. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about his second appearance, the follow-up. Into the Dalek, and I think we just say straight out, this is an improvement, right?
If last week can be summed up by the Rolling Stones song, Mixed Emotions, this one can be summed up by Sympathy for the Fucking Devil.
This one should be called Wild Horses. If Deep Breath could be compared to Mixed Emotions, this one will most definitely be Brown Sugar.
Look, I'm only saying, just gonna say, Beast of Burden.
I guess. Thanks, Shut Mr. Fantastic. That sure is a stretch. Ew.
God, I am not coming to your emotional rescue. Hot stuff.
Tumbling dice.
I was about to say tumbling dice.
Miss you.
Taylor, wait, you went and decided to start me up.
Casey, I miss you.
For a moment, I thought you were actually telling me you miss you, but hey, that joke, that's respectable.
Two out of six.
I can keep going. I can keep going. We haven't even gotten to In Another Land.
Monkey man. Anyway, Casey.
I'm an ice cold lemon pizza, and I could use, or Italian pizza, and I could use a lemon squeeza.
Yes, best lines ever in a song.
Incredibly epic album with a lot of great stuff to say lyrically. And then Monkey Man.
But Monkey Man's a fucking awesome song.
Oh, Monkey Man's awesome, but lyrically, it's a thing.
That's like every band has like that one song that's just like fucking whatever. It's like I Am the Walrus.
Well, I Am the Walrus was intentionally supposed to be that because John Lennon. His idea was he knew people were studying Beatles songs in college. Yeah, so he did that as that. Where, say, something like David Bowie's Heroes, you listen to that and go, you phoned those one in, Bowie.
Save the cheerleader, save the world.
Hey, I wish you could swim like dolphins. Taylor, dolphins can swim.
What? Shut up. No. Speaking of swimming, Doctor Who.
He swam once. Actually, I just watched a Tom Baker last night that where he was swimming at point.
Well, see, there you go, Doctor Who. Okay, so, Into the Dalek, yes. So, we can say right off the bat, an improvement, and it addresses most of our problems with the first episode, right?
It still had the same thing where the first act, I really wasn't feeling it. It felt like it needed a lot more focus and needed to be trimmed down a bit. But then it really came around. I did a full 180 on this.
Yeah, because basically what a lot of this episode is doing is stuff that should have been really done in the Deep Breath, I guess. But that was dealing so much more with just introducing Peter Capaldi. This is kind of introducing the different, the other elements that are going to be part of the season, we think.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
Including another character at the school that Clara works at, who is this teacher. I forget what his name is, but he's a former soldier.
Let's call him Not Mickey.
Because he's a better character than Mickey and treated better than Mickey.
Which is weird, because we don't even know his name.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, let's just say that Clara and this guy have a better relationship than Rose and Mickey did.
Yeah.
And they're not even dating.
Yet.
Oh, it's Danny Pink. Danny Pink is his name.
Yeah, Danny... Oh, yeah, a soldier named Pink and a soldier named Blue.
Yes.
But no, he was interesting. He was definitely interesting. I really hope it's leading there, because I could see him and Jenna Coleman having enough chemistry to bone eventually.
Well, and they're kind of implying that he's going to be a companion, because they deal with this kind of theme with the Doctor. Because, you know, the Doctor's kind of always been, had kind of an aversion to the military and military action. And in this one, since he's pretty much tasked with helping, like, this future military in combating the Daleks, we get to see more of that. And spoilers, at the end of this episode, a soldier, she asks the Doctor, like, can I join you? And he's like, I don't know, maybe if you weren't a soldier, so on and so forth.
Which felt really weird.
It felt a little weird.
Because he has taken soldier... He worked with the fucking military.
Yeah, the Brigadier.
Yeah, Brigadier... I hope he goes to, like, the Brigadier's grave and goes, hey, how you doing, soldier man?
Hey, suck it.
hey, I want to point out, you're dead. And I've died like 13 times and I'm still kicking.
But
suck it.
So that's a bit weird. Maybe it's just kind of, again, I think that's really just set up.
It's set up to something that it's inconsistent with the show as we've seen it, and I did not like that moment. But for the most part, there are a handful of moments. Because the thing is, what these last couple episodes have been establishing is Peter Capaldi's Doctor is easily the coldest Doctor that we've seen in a while.
Who would you think would be the last cold Doctor that we've seen?
Colin Baker at his moments.
Yeah.
And Christopher Eccleston, when pushed, could have his moments.
Yeah, but he was more like two extremes. Yeah. Like, he was cold, but then you have, like, stuff like,
You would have him. Yeah, you would have him be warm. He was hot and cold, and he knew how to do both really well. Whereas, the coldest he is in this episode is when that guy dies, he doesn't even tell him, oh, that dude's dead, or try to save him, or anything like that. And imagine if that scene was with David Tennant. He would have said, oh, I'm sorry. I'm so, so very, very sorry. And looked really sad and would start raining.
And he would wait outside some dude's house.
Yeah, but...
And he'd say, I don't want to go.
Yeah, but he would be really compassionate about, oh my god, there's nothing I can do to save you, but you're going to die. Peter Capaldi's Doctor is just like, no, there's nothing I can do to save him, but I can do some other shits.
Yeah. Because, well, let's talk about what this episode is actually about, which is this military group has a sick Dalek in captivity, and they want to basically enlist a Doctor to go inside.
The Fantastic Voyage.
Yeah, to do the Fantastic Voyage, go inside the Dalek, and do they want to just repair it?
They want to find out why it's like that, I think.
Okay. So they want the Doctor to go in there, and because it's believed... Do they want to, like, convert the Dalek? Is that what they're trying to do?
I think they're just trying to figure out why it's like that. If that can happen, then that can happen to more Daleks.
Well, what do they mean by... What do you mean by that? Like, what's
wrong? If the Dalek can be anti-Daleks, want to destroy other Daleks, then it can definitely...
Yeah, because it's appeared to have turned good.
Yeah, then why not? Well, not even turned good, but it wants to destroy the other Daleks.
Well, that's kind of an interesting idea they present, is that what is good and what is bad. It's good to us because it wants to kill Daleks, and to us that's a good thing, so we associate it as being good. But in the end, it's not really good. It's just that it's on our side.
Yeah, and that's one of my favorite parts of this episode, where they tell the Doctor he is a good Dalek. Mm-hmm. And I like that. Like, the show's not trying to slink away from the fact that Peter Capaldi's Doctor is a lot colder. They call him out on it for his bullshit.
Yeah, because
Thing is, I feel like they juxtapose it with him being... they juxtapose his coldness with scenes of, say, him telling people, here's what you have to do, and they follow his orders, and then you have Clara saying something like, he'll get you out of this, but not... But you'll want to kill him before it's over. And it's more out of annoyance than out of, oh my god, you just let a guy die. Mm-hmm. And it makes it harder to have the character motivations. It makes it harder to understand why Clara would want to follow this guy on a journey. Mm-hmm. So there are problems with how they're developing that. And that's another reason why it kind of bugs me that in Stephen Moffat's era, it's been a thing of, hey, I'm going to take you on an adventure, but I'm going to drop you off before the end of the episode. He just ends up going on an adventure, and then he drops them off, and then he takes them again next week, which could be a few days, it could be a few minutes, or it could be a few months. And that kind of bugs me. I kind of wish it was just consistently, and now we're going here, and now we're going here, and now we're going there.
Yeah, because... I guess the only real reason they do that is so they can develop... Well, they want to develop the companions outside of being with the Doctor, which is kind of weird, but obviously that's what...
Well, I think it worked better with Amy and Rory than it did with...
Yeah, because they could bounce off each other, and they have a more interesting thing, like in Season 7, where they're aging faster, and they're trying to have a normal life, because mm-hmm. they know that they can't be these time-traveling adventurers their entire life. And
even then, it still hints at, like, oh, just because they're doing, we're just showing one adventure, doesn't mean they're having only one adventure and then they're being dropped off. One of my favorite moments in that season is in The Power of Three, they end up being told, they end up telling his dad,
Arthur Weasley.
They're wearing different clothes. Why is that? How long have they actually been gone? And he goes, 7 weeks.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea, and I guess that's one of the things I like about what Moffat has done as the showrunner, is that he plays around with time and, like, the repercussions of time travel and using it more as a plot, I guess, device. You know, he plays around with the idea of time travel.
Oh, no. With Davies, and in fact with most Doctor Who writers, they just did it as, and now we're getting to this point. But for the most part, time was pretty damn linear. Even if they're hopping through time, they're not gonna meet somebody who they haven't hung out with yet.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons why I think the Pandorica opens and the Big Bang are, like, two of my favorite episodes of the Moffat era. It might be my personal favorite finale.
Mm-hmm.
Of Moffat's run. Maybe of the show that I've seen, I don't know. That's something I think Moffat should always get credit for. You know, outside of the whole, he doesn't always deliver on the mysteries and his wrap-ups can be convoluted.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Time of the Doctor? Is that the Matt Smith's final episode?
I think...
The Christmas special, the last Christmas.
Yeah, Something of the Doctor.
Well, yeah, there's fucking three of them. There's a trilogy of the Doctor. But...
Yeah, it was Name, then Day, then Time. Yeah.
Okay. That's one of the biggest problems with Time the Doctor, but I think it also plays to the whole time travel aspect, too, where we get to see, like, the Doctor age, and I think we see a lot of... We talked about last episode, the characterization, which is what you said is one of your favorite things that he does.
Yeah.
With Matt Smith Doctor. Mm-hmm. So on that end, that's where Time of the Doctor succeeds. And I think...
Oh, that episode definitely succeeds more in plot than it does in... Or in character more than it does in plot.
Yeah, it's definitely... You could tell that that's kind of its goal, is just, like, let's just at least send off... 11th Doctor. That's mm-hmm. the primary goal, which works and also doesn't work. But back to Into the Dalek, I think they're getting their footing on characterization for Capaldi's Doctor, as you were saying. I think this handles the whole, like, is he good or is he bad thing better with the Dalek line, you're a good Dalek, because it's again, it plays to that whole theme of, like, what is good, what is evil, when really it's just killing is killing.
Yep.
And I like that a lot. Do you think, I've heard people say that that they introduced the Daleks a little too early. Do you think it's too early to introduce the Daleks into the season, or?
I don't think so. I think it's nice to see that they, like, it's just getting the Dalek story out of the way and then going on beyond that. Because the thing is, with the exception of Paul McGann, every single Doctor has experienced a Dalek story. In fact, one of Peter Davison's last episodes was a Dalek episode just because they realized, wait, shit, he hasn't met the Daleks yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Daleks are arguably the most iconic thing about Doctor Who, besides maybe the TARDIS.
At least of the villains.
Of the villains. Characters.
Yeah.
You know? It's just kind of interesting because I saw someone kind of compare it to Christopher Eccleston's first, you know, well, his season, where it was like episode 6 called Dalek. And someone was talking about how we got to kind of develop Eccleston's Doctor and then introduce him to his arch enemy. So I wasn't sure if you thought it was too soon or not. I feel like I would have to see the whole season to really kind of see if it was too soon or not.
Yeah, this is like as we're going to have to look at a lot of the season as a whole, from what I'm noticing.
Yeah, because we're kind of in the Wild West right now.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. I did like that they did something different with the Daleks, at least something that we haven't seen in a while. I just like the fact that it's not just, oh, the Daleks want to destroy stuff.
It's one rogue ship and then some Daleks.
Yeah, there's maybe like 4 Daleks in this episode. I mean, they might reuse the same footage of the same 4 to make it look like there's more, but who knows? And also, I love exploding Daleks. It's kind of the best secretly funny thing.
Yep.
It's like when you
put something in the microwave for too long.
It's just like explosion. What else? I did like the whole bit about, I like that we see some compassion, well, not compassion, I guess, but just kind of a reverence for life, in a way, with Capaldi's Doctor trying to convince the, you know, the Dalek.
Yeah, that was a turning point, and it's, again, one of those things where it's hard to reconcile. At this point, Piers Capaldi has this moment where he's the Doctor, and he's the dark version of the Doctor, for lack of a better phrase. And they haven't quite reconciled the two of them yet.
Yeah.
And once they figure out how to reconcile them, once they figure out how to bounce it back to forth, then I think they'll be cooking with bacon. But for now, it's a little touch and go.
So you said it basically pulled a 180 for you. Was there like a point, like an exact point where it pulled that 180?
It was a little after the guy was killed.
Okay.
And the Doctor let him die. There was just a moment where I realized how engaged I was and how the story was moving fast, and they were getting information across without it being too quick, but without it being too slow either. It was well paced. The writing got a lot better. The characterization got a lot stronger, and it really hit home stuff like, am I a good man? I think thematically, the last 2/3 of this works so much better than the first third. In fact, everything works better in the last 2/3.
Yes. I would agree.
It's good.
It's good. Let's see. What else can we talk about? I've heard some people talking about how they found it weird that Clara was kind of unfazed by, like, two people dying.
I think at this point she's kind of fucking used to it.
Do you think it's been long enough?
Well, you have to remember, she saw the entirety of the Doctor's past.
That's true.
Yeah, she is.
Good point.
Like, she is literally. She was probably there for, like, a bunch of things. Like, remember the Community episode where, with Jack Black? He's like, what are you talking about? I've been here the entire time. And he just. And they just do clips from the beginning of the first season. They cut away to him reacting to it. I have a feeling that's what it'd be like that. It's like, oh no, how'd you let Adric die?
Okay, that makes sense. Do you want to talk briefly about this whole Missy stuff that's going on?
Is that the Heaven Lady?
Yeah, the Heaven Lady's name, Missy. How do you feel about that? You know, two soldiers die. Mm-hmm. In this situation, one of them is a guy, because there's these like antibodies in mm-hmm. the Dalek's suit that when there's, you know, some kind of harm done to the inside, they come and neutralize the source. And since these people inside the Dalek suit are the source, then they're neutralized. And mm-hmm. Two of the soldiers die. We see the second one, she valiantly sacrifices herself mm-hmm. and we think she dies, but then she appears in Heaven, which we saw in... Well, I say Heaven is like, oh yeah, Heaven! Like, it's the end of... this is the end. And the fucking Backstreet Boys come out and sing. But no, we saw at the very end of Deep Breath, we saw the half-faced man show up in this tranquil garden patio area, and he was greeted by this woman in black named Missy, and she talks about the Doctor and how... and calls him her boyfriend, mm-hmm. and... Which suddenly makes me think of River, but I'm interested to see where this goes. I don't know how you are, how interested you are about the whole Missy storyline.
I'm still not sure, because that's another thing where it's so vague at this point that I need to see where it's going, and it could go either way. It could be really interesting. It could really rectify the Doctor realizing how many people have died for him or at his hand, or it could just kind of turn into some weird afterlife shit that doesn't really work very well.
But that would be a good idea to have, like, everyone that has died by the Doctor's hands show up in this Heaven place.
Yeah, I'd be interested in that. They'd need to do a lot of explaining.
Yeah.
Moffat, you got some explaining to do.
Because either it's gonna be like season 5, where it's like, okay, for the most part, this makes sense. Mm. You know, the whole overarching storyline. Or it'll be like season 8, where it's kind of jumbled.
This is season 8.
Or not season 8, season 7. Yeah. Which, honestly, season 7 and season 6 are kind of the same overarching thing.
Yeah, well, it's from... Even from the beginning of season 5,
well, yeah,
most of Matt Smith's stuff has been one long story. The thing is, they went back to more episodic stuff, and I wish, and I almost at this point wish that they didn't, because it meant that having 3 episodes to explain pretty much everything involving all the mysteries from seasons 5 and 6 and 7 just went way too quickly and was way too much of a mess when they came to explaining it.
Yeah. But it's kind of funny how season 5 feels nice and wrapped up.
Yep.
But, like, season 6 you can kind of get some of it. Because the Wedding River Song's a pretty decent episode.
Oh, season 6 is a great season. It just doesn't feel as complete as season 5 does.
Yeah. And there's great episodes in season 6. Like, you got The Girl Who Waited. I really like The God Complex. The first 2 episodes are great.
Yeah, first 2 episodes. Most of that season is great.
Yeah.
Like, you just go episode by episode.
There's... Even episodic stuff like Closing Time is a great episode.
Closing Time was phenomenal. A Good Man Goes to War is pretty great. Let's Kill Hitler is a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a legitimately great season. It just doesn't feel as complete and self-contained as other ones.
Yeah. Okay. And then, but anyway, back to the point, which is this Heaven storyline. So this soldier just shows up in Heaven across the table from Missy. And at first it's pretty jarring because it kind of like makes the pacing kind of hit a brick wall. Thankfully it doesn't last super long. Because, you know, we've been in the Dalek for most of the episode.
Yep.
And then, bam, we're in this room with this mystery woman. And it's one of those things where it's like, you can't put it at the end of the episode, because then you'd kind of forget, I would say. You can't just, you know, shoehorn it in, because then it would feel like an afterthought. So, I don't know, where do you stand? Are you fine with where it is?
With where it is now, I was more okay with this episode than I was with the previous one, just because this one was a lot shorter. It's like, hello, welcome to heaven. It was almost a strange cutaway gag.
Yeah.
And that was a lot more interesting than how they did it with that last episode. Because Deep Breath, it was actually, there was a lot of stuff about, I must go to heaven, I must get to the afterlife, etc., etc.
Yeah, it kind of hammered it in too much.
Yeah, it hammered it in too much, and then at the very end, it's like, wait, what? Okay.
All right.
Especially then, I feel like the end of that episode should have been the Doctor and Clara. The last note you see shouldn't be of Tin Soldier Man.
Yeah. Okay. So you're fine with where it is in Into the Dalek?
I like it more in Into the Dalek than in Deep Breath, and I'm interested to see where it goes, and I'm really hoping it doesn't disappoint me, because it could easily go either way.
Yeah. Also, on a side note, I like the whole thing about when... Were they in Glasgow at the end of Deep Breath?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I love how it took them, like, 3 weeks to get coffee. Because at the very end of Deep Breath, they're like, let's go get coffee, and then...
Well, what I love is the Doctor has a tendency to actually get completely lost in time.
Yes. And when you can go to any point in time and space.
Yeah, and also completely in... He also gets lost in space, too, because, like, there have been at least 4 separate instances where he's gone to drop a companion off, and he drops him off in the wrong spots.
Yep. So, what would be your overall review of Into the Dalek?
It starts off inconsistent, as did the first episode, and I was really concerned that it was just going to be a thing, that these Pierre Capaldi episodes are just going to not gel with me at all. And then suddenly it started getting a lot better, and it stayed getting better, and consistently was great throughout the entire last half of the episode. I was engaged. I thought the action was done real well. I thought it was funny when it wanted to be funny. I thought it was really interesting when it wanted to be interesting. I thought it was compassionate. I think that they have some trouble reconciling the darker elements of Peter Capaldi's Doctor with the lighter elements. And I'm hoping that they get that figured out really soon. But overall, I really enjoyed this episode. I'd probably give it a B.
Okay. I'd probably give it an 8 or an 8.5 maybe. And I agree on most parts. I think I like how simple this episode is.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, after last episode where it got really convoluted and all over the place, it's nice to have a very self-contained episode.
Yeah, I'm hoping that there's a lot more just easy self-contained ones for a little bit.
Yes. And I like that this addresses a lot of the problems we had with Deep Breath. I feel like Peter Capaldi is more as... come into his own more in this one, and is less Matt Smith-esque, which you could just chalk up to the fact that it's a regeneration episode. Mm-hmm. I like the...
Well, I don't think they knew how to write Capaldi yet, and then they figured it out.
Yeah. Well, it's nice having a second person there, because this is... I think it's Phil Ford is the name of the guy who co-wrote this episode, and he's done a lot of stuff in the past. Mm-hmm. I think it's nice to have a second, you know, second hand in the script too, but I like the morals that it brings up. I like, I don't know, just a lot. It just feels like a better all around package than Deep Breath. And mm-hmm. I'm excited for Robot of Sherwood. Did you see the preview for that one?
Wait, is that the name of the episode? Robot of Sherwood?
Yeah, it's about Robin Hood.
Oh, that means that they've already spoiled it. It's a robot. Fuck.
Well, who knows if it's a robot? Who knows what robot it is?
Is this gonna be the episode, like the episode from season 2 where they introduce the Cybermen and then they make a big reveal at the end that the Cybermen are back?
I don't know. I'm looking at the episode itself, and it doesn't seem to be anything. It's written by Mark Atiss. And Mark Atiss, who is kind of Moffat's secondhand or right-hand man, I should say. And
he's the Vice Moffat.
He's the Vice Moffat.
Grand Moffat Tarkin.
Marketese is my number one candidate to take over the show after Moffat leaves, but I don't know if he
that's okay. Mine's Neil Gaiman. It's okay.
Well, obviously, if Neil Gaiman was, like, a reasonable option, then yeah, but Neil Gaiman's got his own shit going on.
Name one TV show he's writing right now.
He's working on books and shit and comics.
Well, yeah.
That's what he does. He works.
I want Neil Gaiman to write it just so I can say someone who looks like me is a showrunner.
Well, we can just get that dude from fucking that random British comedy, romantic comedy about time travel, whatever.
No, he's in Star Wars, and that can fulfill my dream of wishing I was in Star Wars. Dude, that's my favorite part of the fact that he was cast in Star Wars, is that it's going to make the whole pretend I'm in Star Wars thing that I've been doing since I was six so much easier.
I hope he's, like, under, like, layers and layers of makeup.
That is my fear.
Like, he's the new Jar Jar.
No, someone also said that. What if he's... Like, someone also suggested that. What if Domhnall Gleeson is the Jar Jar Binks of the new Star Wars movies? And I'm just thinking, no.
No.
I actually did find his real Facebook once. I was considering adding him, going, hey, apparently we look alike.
And they just, like, block forever.
actually, he apparently did a musical on Broadway with my uncle once.
Oh, my God. What if you, like, found out so, that you were actually, like, a clone of his? And like he's like, no, he's learning. You mustn't contact me. No, no one should remember that experiment. I destroyed all the notes. There you go. Anyway, if you have Casey, if you haven't seen the trailer for Robot of Sherwood, it looks pretty fun.
I saw the trailer and I really liked it. Ooh, there's Domhnall Gleeson's Facebook page again. Cool. I have problems.
But it's got, you know, all the classic Robin Hood characters. It looks like fun. So, hopefully it'll be fun. And we'll talk about that next week.
I think he's the... Oh my god, he's the son of Brandon Gleeson.
Yeah, you didn't know that?
I didn't know that. Oh. Good for him.
Yeah, one of the Weezy brothers is the son of Matt Moody. And they're in, like, the same scene together.
Or Barty Crouch Jr., take your pick.
Yeah, whatever. Who is David Tennant? Doctor Who!
Oh my god, it all comes together!
Right now.
Good for
over
that.
Me. Also, next week.
That's a Rolling Stones song.
Yes. Also, next week, we will talk about the premiere of Boardwalk Empire.
Oh, we will? Cool.
Yes. Of course we will. It's fucking Boardwalk Empire.
You realize it was next week!
Yeah, I know. Neither did fucking HBO. They pulled a Cora. All right, say goodnight, Casey. See you in the next segment.
I'm trying Ruby Tuesday. Goodbye.
Welcome back to Geeks at College. This is the second segment of this episode. And
please turn to side two of your tape.
Yes. Yes. We're doing something that we haven't done in a long, long time, which is answer fan questions.
Reference Rolling Stones. What?
No, Casey. We're answering fan questions.
Okay, that works too.
Yes. And we have, dare I say, several...
Multiple.
No, this is actually
how many albums did the Traveling Wilburys release? We got that beat.
Yeah, take that, Traveling Wilburys.
Suck it. We are better than Traveling Wilburys. Just saying.
So let's just dive.
Versus Bob Dylan, Casey wins.
Let's just dive right into this. From Ned Coyle, he has two questions. One, what is the most useless superpower you can think of?
All right. I got mine.
Okay, what is yours?
The ability to control how fast your hair and fingernails grow and how slow and able to retract them.
So you're like Wolverine, but with nails and hair?
Yeah, but, like, they're fingernails, so even at the best-case scenario, if you tried to stab some of them, it would probably break.
And thus, like, render you into immense pain.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. You cannot use those things to fight crime. All you can do is look kind of good.
I still like the idea that someone can travel through time, but they only travel, like, slightly faster. So instead of, like, you know, normal speed that time flows, they go, like, 1.1 times faster.
No, I like the ones where it's, I like the ones where it's almost like, you know, when you're watching a movie on some DVD players, you can play at 1.5 times speed, yeah. And it's, like, that's what I picture that being.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. Okay, and now, so we have our two powers.
Which is, by the way, the best way to watch Peter Jackson's King Kong, just for the record.
It goes from, like, in that case, when you do that, it ends up being only 4 hours.
So. Well, it's, in all seriousness, that makes it a 2-hour summer blockbuster. AKA what it should be.
But he came out in the winter.
I keep forgetting he came out in the winter. Because nothing says Christmas like Silverback Gorillas.
Well, I mean, Peter Jackson hasn't released a movie that wasn't in the winter.
When was Lovely Bones?
I want to say, I'd be surprised if Lovely Bones was. Let's see. But anyway, the other part of the question is, Casey, how would you use this power to take over the world?
I would make myself look really good so that then I could look really proper and people go, oh, he's so sexy. And then from there, I will get power, be it a Congress position or a Senate position or just a judge position. And with that power, I would accumulate more power, always looking like a man of wealth and taste. Until finally, I rule the world.
Let's see. I would do it where...
You have to remember, I'm the kind of guy who was once said, hey, would you like to be vice president of a Star Trek club? And my immediate reaction was, can I use it to rule the world?
Okay, my way would be I would... Or not even me, just my character. I would become a... Would this? Do you think this would affect my reflexes? My power?
Are you just going faster than everyone else, or?
Well, technically, I would be slightly faster if we're going by Clock Stoppers rules.
Well, Jonathan Frakes movies do not apply to this conversation.
But I'm just saying, like, if you like, time slows down. So wait, would you be slower?
No, I don't think it would. I think that you would just perceive things slightly faster than the average person, but they're still happening at the same rate. You wouldn't be able to stop something. You would move at that faster speed, as would everyone else. You would get to the end.
So are there literally any benefits to this?
No, there are not. You would feel like if you lived 60 years, you would feel like you only lived 55.
Maybe that phenomena, that feeling that I would feel that you just described would give me more zeal in life and thus would make me want to pursue success more. And thus I would just be a successful person and I would just become a successful CEO of a cable company and thus be the ruler of the world.
I don't know.
It all comes down to having that drive to succeed.
Taylor, I'm going shenanigans on this one. You cannot rule the world that way.
Casey.
At least I came up with that will make me more seductive and thus I can gain power over people and influence.
Yeah, but I mean,
it's not that like I otherwise wouldn't have. Taylor, you've seen how I keep myself. Imagine if I had the ability to control where my hair was or where my fingernails are. I could look damn...
I like how you make it sound like it's not just you're controlling the length of them. You're like, controlling their, like, location and temporal space. Like, they're not on my head. They're over there. Inside your stomach.
But Taylor...
That's how you fight crime. So, thus...
But Taylor, that too. Imagine that. Imagine
that's part of your power. That's part of the power.
Yes. Let's.
So, wait, it's not useless anymore. You can literally just shove your hair in someone's stomach and kill them and usurp their power.
All right, fine. Then it's no longer part of the power.
Okay, now, Mr. Screenwriter, make my power take over the world.
Okay. So, your ability to perceive things faster than the average person means that you have more existential crises.
Go on.
Then I don't know. Your power's fucking useless.
Yeah, it's the most useless power.
I don't know, my power, I think, is the perfect level of totally useless.
No, Casey, this has to be the most useless.
God, of all the Jonathan Frakes time travel movies, you pick Clockstoppers.
So, I let's.
You could have gone with Star Trek First Contact, but you won't with Clockstoppers.
At the end of the day, I thought of a more useless superpower than Casey.
And I would say we'll figure out, think of one that is pretty damn useless, but use it to take over the world. Just think about this. If you want to look empowered, you can make yourself grow facial hair. If you want to make yourself look young and naive and innocent, you can make yourself look very young and baby-faced.
Casey, it doesn't sound very useless at all. That sounds very, very useful.
Yeah, but when you just think about, oh, you can control where how your body hair grows.
I'm pretty sure there was a character in, like, Grant Morrison's run on New X-Men that had that mutant power. He was one of the shitty mutants, but he was still better than the Chicken Kid.
That sounds like a Hey Arnold character, I'm just saying.
Well, yeah, because Pigeon Man sounds like the cousin of Pigeon Man.
Or Monkey Man.
But, to be fair...
Why did they play that song in the episode Monkey Man?
To be fair, Casey, I thought of a better use of your power than you did. Temporal placement of fingernails and hair.
But.
So in the end, we're all winners.
Okay, you know what? Discrediting the whole temporal placement part, if you were to say, get rid of the finger, keep on making fingernails and putting them down other people's throats, eventually they'll get appendicitis and die.
Not if they eat enough fiber.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, we're all winners.
I just got told if you bite your nails, you're going to die of appendicitis.
No.
10th grade of school is weird, man.
That's not how it works, Casey.
Oh, they lied to me.
Thanks for the question, Ned. Moving right along. Obviously, the most important question. Would Casey eat a quesarito for King Kong versus Godzilla to happen?
No.
Wow.
I've moved on, man. I've moved on to King Kong versus Mothra, motherfucker.
Why?
I mean, Mothra and Kong are proportional size. King Kong and Godzilla. Godzilla would tragically step on Kong, even though Kong is a smarter animal. Here's one that I'm actually kind of disappointed never came about. King Kong versus Jaws.
How big is Jaws?
He's like 25 to 30 feet.
How big's Kong?
25 to 30 feet.
Well, obviously for it to work, you'd have to throw Kong in the ocean.
Yeah.
You can't have, like, I like how we're calling it Jaws when, like, fucking sharks never give it a name. It's just the shark.
How about Bruce? How about we call him Bruce?
Bruce. I'm just imagining, like, so you have Kong on, is it Skull Island?
Yep, Skull Island.
Yeah, Skull Island.
Even though it was not called that until the Peter Jackson movie. It was referred to as the island with the mountain of the skull beforehand.
Well, that island. I'm just imagining, like, the shark from Jaws just walking on. Like, just face completely, like, you know, it's like you literally just took it like a clip art of a shark and just made it walk on its two tail fins. And that's the fight.
Look, I'm just saying... If they got them near each other, that would be a cool fight, man. And think about it. King Kong's public domain. You can use that character in anything. Universal was really desperate for things related to Jaws. Why the fuck was that movie not made?
Because, obviously, Jaws, the franchise, was just too serious to incorporate Kong.
Actually, did I tell you? I found out... You know how we found out there was a novelization of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band?
Yeah, and I told you there's a comic that's only in France and Denmark and Japan.
Tragically, it was never imported to America as it deserved. But there's actually a novelization of Jaws Revenge.
I'm not surprised.
Apparently, and also explains why the shark actually tried attacking them. Apparently, it wasn't the shark going out for revenge.
Wow, way to, like, mistitle your movie, guys.
But no, what it was apparently the Brodies pissed off somebody who really believed in voodoo and was using a voodoo curse that materialized in the form of a shark.
That's better.
That's stupider.
That's amazing.
Somehow the explanation. Just think about it. Somehow the explanation of why Jaws 4 is so stupid is actually more stupid than Jaws 4.
I know, but I mean, the thing is that the, I don't know, I feel like the whole idea that the shark just wants revenge is kind of a cop-out and isn't super creative. I give him props for this. Like, oh man, it's this voodoo-driven shark.
Voodoo that, shark.
Like, revenge is in no way part of the motive, even though the movie and this novelization are called Jaws 4, The Revenge.
Well, it's the revenge of whoever's doing the voodoo curse.
Obviously.
Yeah, apparently they pissed off some... In fact, there's a line in the movie, and for all I know, this is going on an original script from that, but the line... There's a line when Michael just says, "You don't believe this voodoo horseshit, do you, Mom?" or something like that. And but he particularly says voodoo. It's just like, who brought up voodoo? Where are you getting that, Michael?
Who do the voodoo? You do.
I think that movie's overrated, babe.
Now, but it has Mick Jagger, the Bowie.
If Mick Jagger played the Goblin King.
Mm-mm.
Or if we're just going through the Rolling Stones, if Charlie Watts played the Goblin King.
Or if we just had David Bowie and Mick Jagger both play that character and just did a Dancing in the Streets remake. Come on, now.
Okay. You know, apparently the song Angie's about them boning.
Okay.
No, I'm being dead serious. Apparently, David Bowie's wife, Angelica, walked in on Mick Jagger and David Bowie clearly in bed, naked, under a blanket together. And she has said to this day, that has happened, that's happened, and they've never tried to deny it. Now, realistically, that song was actually written about heroin because Mick Jagger never wrote a word of it. It was all Keith Richards. But that's another...
Who I'm assuming wasn't there, unless he was like in that, like, it was actually a three-way.
No, at that point, it was at his wake the first time they thought he died, and then he woke up a few hours later. He just kind of looked like a corpse.
And it never changed. But anyway, thank you, Stephen. Stephen Ingram, Geeks of College.
Stephen Ingram, everybody.
Thank you. Casey would not eat a quesarito for King Kong vs. Godzilla to happen.
Now, for King Kong vs. Jaws, I'd nibble a bit.
Casey would, you know, partake in some voodoo to have the shark go after the Brody family. All right, moving
also,
right along.
Also, fun fact, I just got the Blu-ray Criterion of All That Jazz, and it said underneath all the directing credits, novelization available by... And it's like, oh my god, there's a novel of All That Jazz. Another musical.
Yes.
How many fucking 70s musicals got novels?
I have no idea.
Because Grease got one, Sgt. Pepper got one, All That Jazz got one. I'm willing to bet if you look, Tommy fucking got one.
I could see Grease definitely getting one. I mean, freaking Xanadu had a comic.
Well, dude, I found a little text, like, segment of the Grease novel. You know how they deal with the fact that it's a musical?
Hmm.
They actually just have people say the dialogue. Like, John Travolta says, insert the really awkward song lyrics, and then What's-Your-Face also says it. Was it Olivia Newton-John in that one?
Yeah, it was Olivia Newton-John.
Yeah, so they would do a back and forth as the lyrics to the songs, and just makes for really awful dialogue. Which is admittedly better than what they do in Sgt. Pepper novel.
Bang, bang, bangy, chang, shoo-bop.
Hey. If only the Grease novel just listed bands for 5 pages.
My fucking god.
That fucking novel.
I think we're, like, giving it too much credit by calling it a novel.
The fucking collection of words strung together in order to tell a story.
It's a poorly put together collection of paper that happens to have words on it that mean nothing.
Yeah, just Taylor, does that ever just weird you out? And I know we might have isolated everybody listening because they have no idea what the fuck we're talking about, but Does it weird you out that that book got published? Do you ever just sit there and think, I'm part of a species that decided to make this book a thing?
Nah.
Oh, okay, I guess it's just me.
It's just you, Casey. If you guys don't know what we're talking about, look up the Sgt. Pepper Lonely Hearts Club Band movie starring Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees.
And then after you finish that, look up the novel. You'll probably find it for a dollar on Amazon. You can find so many better ways to spend that dollar. Go to a strip club, please.
You can't even use a dollar in a strip club. It's like, oh, I like this girl. Here you go. Okay, I'm going to go now. Okay, bye.
That would still be better than the
fucking... Yeah, I know.
Your use in fucking book.
But I mean, you might as well have said that you could just flush the dollar down a toilet.
If you lit that dollar... If you lit that dollar on fire, put a birth control pill in the center, and tried to smoke it, that would be a better use.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on.
Fine.
Sam Brutuxen, our lovable dinosaur friend, asks, do you believe with all your heart that the Quesarito can be the highest selling item at Taco Bell?
Yeah.
Also, he
these
asked,
are mostly gag questions this year, this week.
No, he has a second real question.
Oh, fine.
He says, also, how do you guys feel about Nintendo's strategy for the handheld market with the new 3DS? Do you know anything about this?
There's a new 3DS?
Yeah, they announced a new 3DS, and it's called the new 3DS.
Oh, man, I was hoping it would be a 4DS.
And apparently, from what I've heard, it aims more for the hardcore, which... If people haven't heard, one, I would like to mention that it is actually Nintendo's 125th anniversary this year.
Really?
Yeah, because I don't know if you knew, but
I knew that they were around before they started doing video games and then became almost exclusively video games.
Well, they made playing cards, I believe it was.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. And so, recent news, they announced a new 3DS. I believe it's bigger and lots of other stuff, but if you look at it, I think a lot of it is they're trying to do kind of subtle subconscious references to what they used to do with their controllers. Kind of like a nostalgia thing. Because now the X, Y, A, and B buttons are blue, green, red, and yellow, which is reminiscent of the Super Nintendo.
Yep.
They have... You know, button layout colors that are reminiscent of the GameCube, which a lot of people hold nostalgic value for. I believe it's going to support the... Do you know about their Amiibo figures?
No, I didn't know about that one either.
Well, you know about Disney Infinity and Skylanders and how they use figurines, right?
I think I knew that one, yeah.
Yeah, where you basically buy figurines that you can use in the game. And so... Nintendo has decided that they're going to do something similar to that, where you can buy these figurines of different Nintendo characters. Initially, it's mainly to go alongside the new Smash Brothers that's coming out at the end of the year. And, you know, you got Mario, Princess Peach, Pikachu, Samus, Donkey Kong, so on and so forth. And they haven't said a whole lot about, like, their complete... function, but we know that you can like put stats or something on them, like they become like a character that you can take with you wherever and you can use on it, because you can use how you use it is that you use the Wii U gamepad and you just put the figurine on the screen and that activates it, and apparently they're integrated that into the new 3DS where you can use the touch screen at the bottom similarly to that. So and it's actually a really smart idea. I know people are like, oh, it's not worth the money. I mean, apparently each figure is going to be like $12, which is actually cheaper than most similar types of figurines. And I think even compared to the Disney Infinity figures, it's cheaper. And a lot of people just buy those figurines just to have the figurines. They don't even know that you use them for games. I know our friend...
I know, I would.
Yeah, like, I know our friend and colleague Ryan Heiss, who works at a GameStop. He's told us, or at least told me, that people just buy the figurines, not even knowing that they go to a game. They just buy the figurines thinking that they're toys, which is kind of brilliant because it can serve two functions. It can be used for the game or it can just be a collectible. So,
yeah. I mean, I definitely bought shit like that, but then again, I never pay attention to what I'm buying. I just grab things blindly and hope I enjoy them. That's how I ended up with a PlayStation 3, everybody.
Yeah.
But, seriously, I went in there hoping to buy a Snickers bar, and suddenly I had a new credit card.
But apparently the new 3DS is going to have even more power to it, so it's going to have more complex games, and in a sense that also means more hard, quote-unquote hardcore games. Which, I don't know about you, but I've never been a huge fan of, like, hardcore and casual.
If I enjoy it, I play it.
Exactly. It's like, obviously there are games that are super simple. Like, obviously, like, Wii Sports is a very simple game. It's a pick-up-and-play game. It's made for the casual audiences. I'm doing finger quotes.
But it's I can see them in my heart.
In your heart. And it's, like, obviously something like the Uncharted games or a Madden game or GTA 5 are more hardcore games than that. You have to put more time into them. That's how I would define it. Not since, like, oh, you're not hardcore if you play this, blah, 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 you know. Mm. Something to... I don't like it as an adjective to describe the player. I like it more as, like, a description of how much time you have to pretty much commit to the game to enjoy it. And there's actually a recent article that came out about Shigeru Miyamoto, how he says he's pretty much lost all... He's just not interested in catering to, like, handheld or, like smartphone game audiences because he sees them as passive. I think he even said it was, like, kind of pathetic, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. But I can kind of see where he's coming from, where, you know, people are very passive, like people that play Farmville or a lot of Facebook games, Candy Crush,
whatever. And yet somehow you see people spending hours and hours and hours on those games.
Yeah, but...
Like, you know. I can tell you, I've put full... I might have put 20 hours into, say, 2048.
What's 2048?
Oh, you don't know about 20... It's a browser game where you're given 16 squares. It's 4x4 grid. And
oh, I know this game, yeah. Like a puzzle game.
Yeah, it's a puzzle game. You're trying to get up to 2048. And I've put hours and hours in. I've never won.
Yeah. But I guess... I know a lot of people have criticized Nintendo for not having the hardcore gamers, you know, in mind.
They do lighthearted stuff. Honestly, it bugs me when people talk about that with Nintendo. And to say... Nintendo is inferior because it doesn't partake to hardcore gaming is like saying that The Dark Knight Rises is better than The Avengers because it is grittier. It's just Nintendo likes more lighthearted stuff, and hey, it makes them money. And hey, I'm not complaining. I like that they like that stuff.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of double standards. Not to say that, of course, Nintendo is infallible. They've made mistakes. They're slowly coming out of the hole with the Wii U because of mistakes they've made. But I think there's a lot of double standards in regards to Nintendo. Everyone talks about how they overuse franchises, and it's like, what company doesn't overuse franchises? You know, I think we have, like, what, the 25th Madden game? We have... What's that?
Something like that.
Something like that. I mean, it's called Madden, you know, 15, but it's not the 15th Madden game. I can tell you that much, because they've been around longer than 2000.
I think at this point it's Madden 2048.
Yeah, exactly. Battlefield Madden 2048. But it's like, when you have something like it, and it's also different for Nintendo, I think, because their franchises have been around for so much longer than most other companies. And you have other companies
What was the game that they tried making PlayStation All-Stars or whatever it was?
Oh, yeah, PlayStation All-Stars, which
it doesn't really work because they don't have because Sony and PlayStation don't have, with the exception of Nathan Drake, any character exclusive to them that's iconic.
Well, they have more than that. They have Ratchet and Clank, Sly Cooper, Kratos from God of War. They have, you know, iconic. They have iconic characters, but they don't necessarily have. They don't have necessarily the history of Nintendo. Like, Nintendo's been around for over 30 years.
And it's been around for 125 years.
Well, but I mean, as a gaming company, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
A video game company. And there's other problems with PlayStation All-Stars, which is actually free for PlayStation Plus members to download. Paid for by Sony.
Are you a PlayStation Plus member?
Well, yeah, because the bundle I got had a free...
Oh, okay.
Year-long subscription. Because, I check up on PlayStation Plus because, you know, every month they have new games that you can download for free as long as you're a paid subscriber. But then it's like I saw PlayStation All-Stars and I was just like, oh, man. When you had stuff like Bioshock Infinite and Sly Cooper 4 and stuff like that, it was like, eh. Well, and there's also... They're obviously trying to ape the style of Super Smash Brothers with PlayStation All-Stars. It's pretty much on it, like...
It's not even trying to hide it.
Yeah, like, which you can't really hide it at all. Yeah, but there's also weird...
their honesty.
Well, there's weird gameplay mechanic decisions that they made. Like, you know, in Smash Brothers, you can just knock someone out of the ring.
Yep.
They go too far off screen and they die. You can't do that in PlayStation All-Stars. It's a little convoluted, and I'm not completely sure how it works, but there's a different way that you have to knock people out in order to win. But
which I'm not necessarily inherently against, because one of the things that does bug me a tiny bit, not enough to ruin the game for me, but does bug me a little with Super Smash Brothers, is that you can only beat people by knocking them out. There's no health limit. All you can do is make it harder for people to bounce back from being hit.
I guess, but I would say that that's what made it stand apart from all... Because you have to remember, the first Smash Brothers came out in 1999,
I believe. Wow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Smash Brothers Melee for the GameCube came out in 2001, I believe, and...
God, Bill Clinton could have gotten that at the White House. Wow.
Yeah, and...
We all know Bill Clinton was a huge Nintendo fan.
And at the time of the first Smash Brothers, everything was like a fighting game with a health bar. So, mm-hmm. I could see the percentage being is like, okay, we need to think about this differently in order to make us stand out. Because they could have just made, you know, another fighting game.
Alright, I'll buy that for a dollar.
Well, and it's also called Smash Brothers, and they at least use, like, Smash. Because you have Smash moves, which are generally the moves that you do to knock people out of the ring.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess you could see it in a way it's more like... wrestling or like sumo wrestling, where it's like it's all about just getting someone out of the ring.
I can see that.
So yeah, I mean that's a Japanese sport.
It didn't ruin the game for me or anything. That was just what I thought, but hey, you made me think about it differently, Taylor,
and that's half the battle. Geeks at college.
Oh, okay.
Geeks at Joe. Well, back to my point, I think Nintendo is one of the few people that they still use their characters that have been around for 30-plus years. You have Capcom, who apparently doesn't even get a shit about Mega Man, to the point that Mega Man's being in the next Nintendo game. And I swear, Nintendo should just buy Mega Man from Capcom and just make Mega Man games. Same, it's like Sonic, which, granted, Sonic's only been around as long as I have been around. And...
Yeah, that means Sonic's older than I am.
Yep, Sonic's older than you. But I just think there's the entire industry has a tendency to overuse properties, not just Nintendo. The only reason we're saying that is because Nintendo's been around longer.
Yep.
You know, but they've managed to reinvent the wheel, so to speak, with stuff like. Yeah, Mario's games are always about jumping on stuff and getting coins, but you go from the 2D ones to Super Mario 64 to Super Mario Sunshine and, you know...
Galaxy.
The Galaxy games, which are awesome, and now you have 3D World,
Dude, Galaxy's my favorite Mario game.
It is. It's a fantastic game. And you have stuff like this, the Metroid Prime games, which totally change the perspective that you play those games. And so they're also one of the companies that have survived through both. They were a big name on both the 2D side of gaming and the 3D side of gaming.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been through most generations of gaming. So, I don't know. I'm trying not to sound, because I am a Nintendo fan. I've been most of my life. And I don't want to sound too biased, but, you know, I think it's good for them. It's a good idea to cater more towards the hardcore, because I'm always sick of people saying that, like, oh, they make kiddie games or whatever. It's to your point. It's like, yeah, they make lighter stuff, but it doesn't mean that the mechanics aren't there and the game design's not there. It's just a different coat of paint, really. It's like, did you hear about the new game that they announced called Splatoon?
No.
Yeah, it came out. It's a new IP that they announced at E3, where it's basically a multiplayer-only third-person shooter, but instead of killing people, which, granted, you kind of can't kill people in this, you're just trying. It's basically a turf war, where you're spraying ink everywhere, and you're on different. You have different colors. So one team would be blue, another team would be orange, so on and so forth. And you try to paint your color more of the map than the other team.
Oh.
Yeah, and it's like, if you look it up, it's called Splatoon. And it's really fun looking, and I think it's inventive. And I think it's something kind of fresh, you know? Because, again...
Like, how you just described it, it sounds like a first-person shooter, only where people aren't dying... Which is kind of like that's around the gray areas. Is it if it's the exact same game, only something has people dying, but you're using the exact same mechanics and it's just getting people hurt or getting people knocked out or getting people to do something really silly? Is it really, does it mean that it's no longer, it's just a kiddie game?
Exactly. It all comes down to the game mechanics, you know. That it's the graphics and the art direction obviously help to lift up the mechanics. It's how we are shown the mechanics, but at the end of the day, it's all about the mechanics. So there you go. So
yeah.
I hope that this is successful for them. I mean, the 3DS is already super successful, even though the fact that It's kind of impressive that it's as successful as it is when there's so many 3DS models, you know? Because that's one of the things where there was a Nintendo DS, and then there was a DSi, and then there was a DS XL, and then there's a 3DS, and now there's a 2DS.
Then there was DS PowerPoint, DS Movie Maker,
DS Creative Cloud. And I love when people are like, why does the 2DS look like it does? The reason why the 2DS looks like it does is so people don't get fucking confused. You know, that's why it's just this brick thing that you hold that I don't even think looks that bad, you know?
Yep. My favorite DS is still DS Lite. I like that thing.
Yeah. So
it's dependable, except for that time I left in the Caribbean.
So what do I think of their new strategy? I hope it works out for them. I don't think it's too pandering or anything. I mean, if you're a company that's been around as long as Nintendo, you can afford to pay, you know, to use nostalgia a bit. I mean, heck, other people do all the time. I mean, that's what fucking Smash Brothers is.
Yeah.
but again, it's not just some hollow thing. You know, it's not just nostalgia. It's this really fun game wrapped up in nostalgia.
I guess the bare point of what we're trying to say, as long as it entertains.
As long as games entertain, that's all that matters. It's kind of like where I stand on, like, gameplay versus story. Because I know that's kind of become more debate as games become more and more cinematic. And a game can have a great story. I don't care. It's like, but if a game plays like shit, it plays like shit.
No, that's made true of Shadow of the Colossus.
Well, but what's cool about Shadow of the Colossus is that the thing about Shadow of the Colossus is I give it a lot of leeway, even though I know when I played it, I was frustrated as fuck, and a lot of people are. I mean, watch the Game Grumps play through. It can be a frustrating game because it was made by, like, how many people in Japan? It's like an indie game. But you kind of forget that when you get wrapped up in all the story, too. So it's one of those, like, in the moment, it's like, I fucking hate this game. When you finish it and you're like, oh my god. Because, like, once you beat something, once you beat one of the Colossi, it feels like it's one of the best feelings. Because you're like, you motherfucker, you're fucking dead.
Yeah, 7 years of my life finally paying off.
And that whole thing where it's like, you're kind of supposed to feel bad because you're killing these creatures and you don't even really know why. And then as you go through the game, you kind of become suspicious of your intentions. But there are times where it's like, nope, I'm fucking glad I killed you. Because you were an asshole.
How many times am I going to hear that sentence today?
What sentence?
I'm fucking glad I killed you because you were an asshole.
Well, I know how breaks can be at JCPenney's.
Yep.
Yep.
Sometimes you're not far off.
But was there anything else that you wanted to say?
Yeah, I like turtles. There's nothing more I can think about that. If it entertains me, it entertains me. I admire Nintendo trying to do different things.
I mean, that's why Mario Kart is so resonant with people, because it's just fun.
Yeah. You know,
how many hours did we fucking lose to Mario Kart?
How many days did we fucking lose
to Mario Kart? Exactly. Because those games are fun, you know?
How many weeks did we lose to Mario Kart?
Whenever fucking Steven visited.
Yeah. So, and Steven would typically stay for like a week or two.
Exactly.
God damn it, Steven.
But I hopefully that answers your question. I'm not against it. I think it's pretty smart. Hopefully it's successful. So, and hopefully it works too, because I think they're starting to get, with the stuff that's coming out for the Wii U in the next year and a half, it's pretty exciting. You know, they have a new Zelda game coming out, a new Yoshi game, a new Kirby game, a new Smash Brothers game. They have some stuff coming out from, not third party, but like second party that they acquired, like Bayonetta 2. There's a series called Xenoblade. Well, it's a Xeno series, and it's been around for a while. And they're making it's a JRPG, and it's actually supposed to, Xenoblade Chronicles for the Wii is supposed to be a really awesome RPG, and they're making a spiritual sequel to it called, I think it's like Xenoblade X or something like that, and it's completely different. It's not fantasy, it's sci-fi, and you have mechs and stuff, and it looks really cool. So that's supposed to come out next year too. So I think I mentioned Zelda, like the new Zelda that they announced. It looks fucking awesome. It's basically Skyrim but Zelda.
I'm gonna actually have to check that out.
Completely open world. It's fucking awesome. Look up the trailer, the announcement trailer for it. But I think they can get back on their feet, hopefully. And they're making a new Star Fox game too, from it's believed.
And if not, then you're suddenly going to start getting a lot more Mario Karts.
Well,
either way, win-win.
They're gonna ride Mario Kart for a long time. That shit was successful because they announced two DLCs for it. One where you can play as villagers from Animal Crossing, and one where you can play as Link from Zelda.
Huh.
And the Link one's coming out in the fall, and the Animal Crossing one's coming out in May. And
I'm getting a Wii U and Mario Kart 8. Like, the moment you said that, it's like, oh, I'm buying that.
Yeah. There's going to be a new bundle that's like $300. That's a little cheaper than the original Mario Kart bundle. So, there you go. Buy Wii U's, because they have good games.
So, yeah, I should probably get into the next generation of gaming.
Well, you just bought a PS3, so don't think you should do it too soon. I mean, I'm kind of the same way. I was given a PS3 from my lovely girlfriend for my birthday, so I don't want to just buy a Wii U and be like, oh, that was fun while it lasted, but hey, Wii U.
No, I get that completely.
Speaking of my lovely girlfriend, she was nice enough to...
Lovely Rita, meet you. Oh, yeah, it's Lori.
Yes. My girlfriend, Lori, sent a question in asking, what comics would any of you recommend for someone who is into the supernatural? Like things involving ghosts, demons, etc. We were actually, I took her to the comic shop a couple times. I got her into Batwoman.
Ooh!
Yeah, I bought her the first couple trades, maybe the first three trades of Batwoman. It's really awesome. I recommend it. And she was getting into it because it kind of has a supernatural ghost element to it, which is kind of neat. And she was asking me, you know, obviously before we recorded, like, what are some other comics that have ghosts and hauntings and all that stuff? And it was funny because I was trying to look up stuff, and when you search supernatural comics, all you get is the adaptation of the CW show, and it sucks. It's so frustrating.
God damn it, Supernatural.
God damn it, Dean.
Somewhere out there, Shayla.
So Sam. That's Sam. That's the other guy's name, Sam. Sam and Dean. Yep. I almost said Hank.
I was thinking either Sam and Diane or Sam and
Dean. Sam and Diane Winchester. Brothers.
Dude, if you told me Supernatural was about Ted Danson and Shelley Long traveling across the country fighting ghosts and shit, I'd watch the shit out of that show.
I would, too. I already recommended to her the Hellblazer series, the John Constantine Hellblazer series. What's nice about those is that they're, most of the time, they're collected in trades that are single stories. So they're kind of very arc-based. And obviously that deals with the cockney asshole detective John Constantine as he investigates stuff with demons, the occult, all that stuff. I did some digging on some supernatural books, some comic books. One that's actually, I think, just ended was called Fatale, like Femme Fatale. And
I think I might have heard of that one, actually.
Yeah, it's from Image Comics, and it started in 2012. It's written by Ed Brubaker and drawn by Sean Phillips, who have done a lot of stuff, including, what was it called? I think one was called Incognito. Well, let's look. Incognito, Criminal, and Sleeper. Yes, those are them. And those are great books, too. I've seen some of the art, and I've read a little bit of them, and they're great. Fatale is basically deals with this immortal femme fatale. Like, it's a noir story with supernatural elements that deal with immortality. And there's also this cult that worships cosmic gods reminiscent of Lovecraftian stuff. So
you're saying all the right words. Go on.
And that's all I really know from reading, but...
Oh.
I don't know. I've seen some images. Sean Phillips can fucking draw like nobody's business. He's awesome. And Ed Brubaker does good noir. And just good stuff in general. But this was one that stood out to me. This is by Image Comics. Most of these titles that I've found are from Image Comics.
Because you can make the argument Image Comics is the best comics company right now.
Well, best in terms of variety. Because Image Comics... They do Superior Fare with Spawn, which is also supernatural, but yeah. You have The Darkness, which is also supernatural.
Well, most of their stuff does involve supernatural shit, even if it's not necessarily ghost and monster strips.
Well, I mean, they did The Walking... This is the people that do The Walking Dead and fucking Savage Dragon.
Yep. And, well, they also do shit like Chew.
And Chew, which you said was kind of supernatural.
Like, It's supernatural, not like a old, what's the name? It's supernatural, not like an old Universal horror movie, and more like an X-Files episode.
Yeah, because there's like vampires and stuff like that. And the uncanny ability to be able to tell where someone, what happened to someone in their life.
Once there's a Penny Dreadful comic, I'll just recommend that.
Yeah. Because there's psychic abilities, too. And I guess this is also a good time, because one of the obvious ones that jumps out with supernatural comics is Ghost Rider.
Spirit of Vengeance.
And while I'm not super well-versed in Ghost Rider, I did read the first five issues of the all-new Ghost Rider that started back in March or April, with Marvel. And... What really drew me to that was the artist, which is a SCAD alumni called Trad Moore, who does The Strange Talent of Luther Strode, also by Image. And he does crazy off-the-walls, hyper-violent shit that's still fun because it's very stylized and cartoony.
Ooh.
And his Ghost Rider, which isn't quite as hyper-violent as Luther Strode, is still really fun. I think it's Felipe Smith is the writer of it. Yes, Felipe Smith writes it, and Trad draws it. And it's basically, it's not Johnny Blaze. It's this teenager kind of gearhead named Robbie Reyes, who is a sole guardian of his paraplegic brother. And they live in kind of the ghetto of Los Angeles. And he street races, and he's working on this muscle car in the garage that he works at. And one night he steals it to go use it for a street race. And it turns out that there's this stash, some, you know, important item in the trunk. And these mercenaries come and kill him and steal the stash back. And the car apparently is haunted. And that's where his,
as are most random cars out there these days.
Well, it's intriguing because, you know, the spirit talks to him. It's called, like, Eli, I believe it is. And it talks to him, and I think the Ghost Rider design's pretty cool. Instead of being a biker, he's, like, a race car driver. Trad has a really cool kinetic style to it, to his art. I don't know, it's playful, and it doesn't take itself too seriously, and it's pretty fun. Trad only did the first 5 issues, which I'm assuming will be collected in the first trade. I don't know much more about the guy who's taking over for him, but from the art I've seen, he looks pretty cool too. So, that's a Supernatural comic that I'd recommend. Another one that I looked up was called Drums. It's a limited series, so it's only 4 issues. And it's also by Image, not surprisingly. And
how many, with the exception of the Vertigo titles, how many just flat out Supernatural stories does DC Marvel put out?
I mean, there's stuff with, like, Deadman. Do you know Deadman?
I think I know that
one. He's a character in DC, and he's basically the superhero who is killed. Like, he's killed, and he gains these powers in death, and he's trying to find his killer. And
Someone strike him down and he became more powerful than they could possibly imagine?
Maybe.
I'll tell you that's a myth. Yeah.
But before we get into that, it's called Drums, and it deals with voodoo.
Yay!
And it's about this special agent, Martin Irons, as he investigates this mass homicide of practitioners at a voodoo ceremony in Florida. It sounds pretty good from what I've seen.
No, you're saying all the right words right now.
So I would say that one would be good to look into. Then a couple more. One is called, it's not so much horror as it is fun, but deals with Supernatural, is called 5 Ghosts, and it's, okay.
Coast to Coast?
No. Okay, let me pitch this to you. 5 Ghosts is an ongoing comic book series chronicling the travels of treasure hunter Fabian Gray and his rare ability to harness the ghosts of 5 literary characters.
Go on, I'm interested.
He's inflicted after an encounter with an artifact known as the Dreamstone. This encounter has given Gray the power to harness the abilities of 5 unnamed literary characters, or ghosts, referred to as the Wizard, the Archer, the Detective, the Samurai, and the Vampire.
Okay, the Wizard, Harry Potter, the Archer, Robin Hood, maybe? If not Katniss.
Probably Robin Hood.
I hope it's Katniss. I haven't even read Hunger Games. I hope it's Katniss.
Cat piss.
You know, one day you and I are just going to need to sit down and actually watch the Hunger Games. So you can...
We're those lamos that haven't watched it.
Yeah, you and I have not watched either of them, nor read the books.
Nope.
So maybe we should, you know, see what the cultural phenomenon's about. Hopefully it won't be like that time I watched Frozen.
Yeah.
Unless it's exactly like how I watched Frozen and I begin imagining Tina Belcher as Katniss. But PETA. I put my bread in your butt.
Anyway. Also, obvious one to mention would be Hellboy. Hellboy is a great one to mention.
Yeah.
Because that deals with both supernatural and Lovecraftian stuff.
And just neat shit in general.
Yeah, and I know Lori's seen the Hellboy movie, so she knows about Hellboy. And then finally, the one that I looked up that really intrigued me, that I've heard of for years, but never read myself, is called Lock and Key.
Oh god, I've been wanting to read that for years.
Yeah, because that's written by Stephen King's son, correct?
Yeah, like Stanley King or something like that.
Oh my god, he fucking looks like his dad.
Okay, when you say that, is it pre-accent or post-accent Stephen King that he looks like?
I don't know, he just looks like his fucking dad. Joseph, Joe Hill, and I don't know necessarily
the pitch. I totally see it. Oh my god.
I just know that this deals with, like, Lovecraftian stuff as well. It's horror based. I've heard lots of good things about it. I know very little about the story. I can say here's the pitch for the first, and I know it's in story arcs too. Mm-hmm. And it's like, number one, after the murder of their father, Tyler, Kinsey, and Bode Locke relocate with their mother to the family estate of Keystone, located in Lovecraft, Massachusetts. Sam Lesser, one of the teens who murdered Mr. Locke, is in a juvenile detention center and by gazing in water communicates with a supernatural force that promises to free him. Bode Locke, the youngest of the family, uncovers the ghost door which separates his spirit from his body. That's the first issue, so if that at all intrigues you...
No, I've been wanting to read that for a number of years now, and I just have never actually seen it in a comic book shop at a time when I've had the money to buy it.
Yeah.
Fucking Lock and Key and you being elusive. It's like it's trying to lock me out of its life and I don't have the key.
And volume 6, I think, came out in February.
With right, the latest, so it's not that far along. It's only like 6 years long.
Well, it's got six story arcs. So that's Lock and Key, and hopefully that's, you know, for both Lori and other people listening who want some good supernatural / horror comics to read, that will give you a nice start. So thank you, Lori, for your question.
Thanks, Lori.
Yay! And moving right along to, I believe, our final question from...
All right.
Our mainstay and good buddy, Jordan Worth Cobb.
Joko!
Who starts by saying, could God make
Joko
a...
Joko Ono.
Could God make a porn parody so good even he can't masturbate to it? And my answer would be...
Probably.
What does God need with a porn parody? Probably. That's the answer.
I'm trying to figure it out. Could he?
As long as it's a porn parody...
I've officially thought more about this joke than I did about the actual God create a boulder so big he himself could not lift it.
As long as it's Logjammers from The Big Lebowski. Or that dream sequence porn that...
From The Big Lebowski.
Okay, that the dude's in.
I kind of love that The Big Lebowski has a porn parody. I hope that they actually go to the porn parody scene of The Big Lebowski.
Yes. But in seriousness, he says, I have finally started reading Preacher, and it is amazing.
Good.
Yes. You've read
That's Preacher? Another supernatural comic, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know next to nothing about Preacher besides it's good.
Oh, dude, you haven't read it?
No, I haven't had a chance to.
Oh, dude. Yeah, I think I actually had the first volume or two in Savannah. I should have loaned it to you.
Well, I guess you're just an asshole, Casey.
Alright, I'm putting that on the list of things I'm going to tell my younger self when I eventually invent the time machine. And I know I will, because my future self came back and said, you're going to invent the time machine.
Anyway, he says, I have started reading Preacher, and it is amazing. Now, being halfway through the series at this moment, count me in the camp worried as hell that the AMC might not work. But that the AMC series, I guess, that they're making, right?
I think AMC is trying to. It's thing is, Preacher is a very, very vulgar book.
Yeah.
Like, my favorite line in the entire book is in volume one. And granted, I haven't finished the book. I've only read the first three or four volumes, I think. But there's a line where the sheriff of a small local Texas town, it's essentially like Arlie Ermey from any Arlie Ermey movie, but particularly the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake. After he sees a church burn down, he just goes, "I reckon it was niggers."
Oh my god.
Yeah, so
it would have to be an HBO at the very least.
I mean,
if not, I mean, Stars.
AMC is a lot looser than other channels about having vulgarity. They will let things pass to a degree. I think that if they're willing to be very liberal with the vulgarity and use the same level of violence that they do in The Walking Dead, they could get it on the air. The question is if they'll be the right network in terms of getting good writers and getting things across. Because they're a network that's hit and miss as hell.
Yeah. But anyway, continuing his question, he says, "But then again, Hannibal on NBC is currently my favorite TV show of all shows airing right now. And I thought there could be no way that that would be done on there."
Same Someone with how hasn't good... seen Penny Dreadful Bob's Burgers.
Same with how good the Constantine pilot was. My question is, what is one property you really love but think it wouldn't work at all being adapted into film or television, but would want to see happen out of purely being curious to see how someone could bring it to life?
I would say Watchmen, but that turned out kind of meh.
Well, again, Watchmen is something that would totally work better as a miniseries.
Yeah.
Because, yes, because every reason.
Oh, let's see. Let me see. The CW's The Walking Dead.
Why are the CW's Walking Dead?
Because the CW does not have the right tone or mindset when it comes to making television to do The Walking Dead.
But is there a property that hasn't been adapted to TV or movies that...
Let's see. Well, I mean, one of my favorite comics of all time we brought up before, but Chew, that's something that doesn't really... that they made a pilot to, but unfortunately did not actually get picked up.
Well, because Chew gets pretty crazy.
Yeah. Oh, Chew gets batshit insane, but yeah. it starts off, like, as long as you have from the very first episode, the chicken speakeasies, as long as you have that, then you can bring the audience along for the ride of, okay, this is going to get absurd. If before the end of the first season you have... his partner has a robot eye. It's like, okay, just fucking cyborgs. What more can you want?
Well, it's also one of the things where I think a live-action Chew is way harder to do than an animated Chew, obviously. Hmm. Well, because you have stuff like Pollo, the crazy superhero masked wrestling chicken.
True.
Like, you have stuff like that. You have the chicken frogs.
Yeah, actually, hybrids. Taylor... did you hear who at one point they were, like, apparently for a while had locked in for the main three cast of the Chew pilot? That I'm not sure if that one was actually the cast that filmed it.
One of them was that one guy from Lost.
And his partner was Josh Holloway.
Oh, that's right.
And Felicia Day. So essentially, that entire thing would have just been one weird nerd threesome.
My god.
I wonder if someone bootlegged that pilot. I need to see that.
I know, right?
Yeah, like doesn't that sound like an amazing show?
It sounds pretty fun. It's just, it's one of those things where they really, it'd be such a tightrope walk to do stuff like what a Chew does in live action. You know, because there's stuff with aliens, there's stuff with, like, you know, Tony Chew's family, and, you know, it gets pretty crazy. And... so,
oh wow, it's getting an animated adaptation apparently.
Well, see, that makes more sense because Chew already has such a crazy, stylized look to it that it just makes more sense to do it as an animated show if you're going to adapt it. Is there any? Does it say who it's trying to market it towards?
I know, I just googled Chew pilot because I'm wondering if that ever got leaked.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's see.
As far as my answer, I would have to say Fables, I think, would be one that's hard.
Well, you could argue that they're doing that with Once Upon a Time.
But see, that's the thing, is that that's Once Upon a Time. Have you read any of Fables?
I've read the first volume, I think.
Well, see, like, Fables isn't just Once Upon a Time, you know? It's not just, oh, look, it's that character from that story. It's got maturity in it, it's got nudity, it's got sex, it's got violence, it's got all sorts of stuff that...
Two of you actually kind of dig Once Upon a Time.
I'm not saying that you shouldn't, I'm just saying they're very different when you get down to... Well, it's like, on a surface level, they look the same. But Fables is I don't know, there's just more going on in it that wouldn't fly on most television networks. It would have to be a Starz or HBO. I mean, and I would definitely recommend going past the first volume. Is it still over the murder of Rose Red or whatever her name is?
I'm honestly, actually, now that you say that, I might not have gotten that far. I know I read a little bit of it.
Well, that's what the first storyline is about.
Yeah, it might have only even been a single issue that I read. I just know that I did try it for a bit.
Well, Fables is one of those things where the first story arc is kind of a grind. It picks up near the end, but it's really in the second storyline, dubbed Animal Farm, that it really starts to click and it gets good. I've got three volumes, like the three like deluxe collector's ones, hardbound copies.
Ooh.
And that's a show where it's like, when you first look at it, you're like, oh, obviously, it's like what we said about Once Upon a Time. Like, it's like, yeah, there's already Fables, it's Once Upon a Time, except, you know, without the nudity or the violence or a lot of the other stuff. And they did make a game adaptation that I want to check out called Wolf Among Us by Telltale. The people that did the Walking Dead game,
yep.
which is better than the Walking Dead show.
And might be doing a Game of Thrones game.
They are doing a Game of Thrones game.
Oh, that I thought that was just rumor at this point.
No, that was announced. They're doing a Game of Thrones game.
Game of Thrones?
Yeah, the Game of Thrones game. That's hopefully the best Game of Thrones game so far, as opposed to that other one.
Fuck that game.
Fuck that game. So, obviously, Sandman is another one that comes to mind that seems kind of really hard to do.
Why the Last Man?
Do you think Why the Last Man would be hard to do as a show?
I think that it'd be difficult to find the right tone to it. It's just one of those things where, in fact, you see this in most comics. Comics don't have the same stark contrast between comedy and drama that a lot of TV shows do. Because most TV shows, you get something that's like, this is so dark, all darkness full of pain, no parents, super rich.
Well, you could argue, would you say that's because TV plays up to more than just, you know, sight, you know, in terms of senses? Because, you know, they use stuff like music and actual sound and delivery of dialogue.
Well, I think it's because, and there's exceptions to this rule. You get shit like Brian Fuller stuff, but when they're trying to appeal to bigger audiences, they just end up going for one constant emotion more often than not.
Yeah.
And if I did, and that's just my theory, but I think it's just you're trying to achieve this emotion, and the overall theme of the show will be like that. Comics, you go in, you might even be expecting, like, oh my god, this will be so dark. And typically it's like, okay, this is dark, but it's also really exciting, this really energetic. Like, Why the Last Man? It's a really charismatic book. That's a very apt word to describe that book.
Yeah. Well, it has such a great hook to it, too. Like, Brian K. Vaughan's just really smart with, like, hooks, you know, I think, between, like, that and, I think, was it Pride of Baghdad, and...
Or what's that space opera he's doing?
Saga, it's basically like, hey, it's like, if you had those two teenagers that read Romeo and Juliet in high school and thought it was an amazing love story, banged each other, and happened to be from warring races and have a kid... That saga.
Yeah, you are not wrong, and from what I've read, I love it.
Oh yeah, it's great.
I think Brian K. Vaughan just probably, he might be my favorite working comic writer.
I think he's just one of my favorite writers, because he does comics, obviously, and TV.
Like under the,
Yeah, I'm not counting under the tongue, but he's done good work in TV.
I hope he eventually just gives up and does a parody of Underdome called Under the Gnome. It's a bunch of people have to hide under a garden gnome.
Like,
indefinitely.
Yeah, the Expedia.
Or is it Expedia? Yeah. No, it's Travelocity.
Yeah, Travelocity.
Dean Norris has to hide under the Travelocity gnome for a season.
Dean Norris is the gnome.
Make I'm it a on show. My way.
What the hell, Walt?
What the hell, Walt? You said we were staying at a 5-star resort. This is 3.5 at best.
You killed Gomi, you bastard. I don't know if this doesn't sound anything like Hank, but whatever.
Our Hank impressions are getting worse and worse.
Oh, well. That's a terrible Hank Venture impression. can you think of anything else? Any other adaptations? Because, like, a lot of the ones that I like, they are, like, The Goon. The Goon's getting a movie adaptation. And The Goon totally works, because the Goon has a very open narrative. Like, there's a storyline, but there's a lot of, you know, it's kind of like X-Files in a way, because, you know, there's that backbone storyline about aliens and, you know.
And then there's also a bunch of standalone fun adventures.
Yeah, and that's The Goon, and I think one of my favorite things about The Goon is kind of what you just talked about with Why the Last Man. In that it juggles comedy and pathos really well. Because when you read The Goon, you look at it, it's a very cartoony book. And I love Eric Powell's sense of humor and his art style. And when it actually gets very serious and very emotional, it takes you by surprise. Mm. It's something you wouldn't expect. And The Goon's one of the few comics that I've actually cried when I read
that
issue. It was the miniseries Chinatown. Which I think is volume 6 in the continuity of the book, which it serves as a prequel to everything, because it takes place before the start of the series. But so if you want a good jumping on point, check out Chinatown by The Goon. Or The Goon's Chinatown by Eric Powell, not by The Goon.
I hope there's a band called The Goon with a song called Chinatown.
GTA Chinatown Wars.
Yeah. Forget it, Jake. It's The Goon Chinatown.
Forget it, Jake. It's GTA Chinatown Wars.
GTA Chinatown would be an amazing game, actually.
That is a game.
Oh, well, fuck it, Doc.
It's a DS game.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wait, GTA as in Grand Theft Auto?
Yes.
Made a DS game?
Yes.
I need to go find my DS in the Dominican Republic and then play that game.
I'm trying to think of other things. I think Tom Strong, which is an Alan Moore series, I don't know if that would really work. That'd be hard to sell. If you haven't checked out Tom Strong, it's really fun. It's like old serials. Do you think League of Extraordinary Gentlemen could work?
I think that it's another case of you have to find the right tone. But if you could make it an a caper movie or a caper series.
Well, that's more or less what the show is, or the comic is, like at least the first volume.
Yeah, but the thing is, I have a bad feeling that it just people try to turn that too much into Avengers and it would be an action movie or an action show.
You mean like the original League of Extraordinary Gentlemen movie? Which is so immensely stupid, I love it. It's horrible.
I don't know, I've never seen it actually.
Oh my god, it's so fucking stupid and bad.
Sean Connery go into retirement.
And the director, too. So two people retired because of that movie.
Wait, who directed that movie?
I don't know, some dude who retired.
Okay. You know Richard Lester, the guy who directed A Hard Day's Night and Superman 3? A, contrast in a career. B, a guy died on his film set during the 80s, and he just felt so guilty he retired afterwards.
Well, John Landis, he is not.
Yeah.
An example however, of the stupidity.
However, he did go to that guy's funeral and say, thankfully, we were done with him. We didn't need him anymore. We finished the movie.
An example of the stupidity of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen movie. So you have the Nautilus, which is Captain Nemo's ship. In the book, it's a cool, like, copper, I don't know if it's copper, but it's like, it's this red submarine shaped like a whale fighting a squid.
Yep, I've seen.
The movie, it's this giant, like, cruise line looking sword shaped thing that's, like, super tall. It's probably, like, 100 feet tall and 100 feet wide. You see this thing go down, like, the canals of Venice. Just that visual.
Again, I'm Google imaging that, and it's...
Like, it resurfaces in the fucking, you know, canals of Venice.
Aw.
These little side canals. It's so fucking dumb.
Yeah, I'm Googling that, and it's like, one of these looks a lot cooler than the other.
And the fact that they don't even understand how Dorian Gray's story works, so, you know, whatever.
I'm really... Actually, you know who really should do League of Extraordinary Gentlemen? John Logan.
Yeah.
It seems like something that's up his alley after... Because what he does is... What he does best is when he's taking things that have been done before... Done before and putting them together into something new, such as, say,
bats.
Hugo. What?
Bats.
Well, yeah, bats, of course, but...
Obviously.
But when you look at, say, Hugo... That's a big homage to that era of cinema, or Midnight. What is it? Midnight in Paris. Blah blah blah. Skyfall. That's a big homage to James Bond movies.
Well, Penny Dreadful as a James Bond movie.
Yeah, but it also has a lot of homages to other James Bond movies in a good way.
Yeah, well, because it's a 50. It's a perfect screenplay for a 50th anniversary special.
Yep, and Rango again has a lot of great. A lot of really great movie references in there. Like, there's a lot of Chinatown references. There's old Western references. There's just classic movie references.
There's Terry Gilliam references.
Yeah, there's... I mean, I was talking to one of my professors, and he actually said, oh, that's my favorite animated movie ever, just because he's a big movie guy and really liked it, and really loved how many references there were in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like he would be really good for stuff like that, especially seeing, like, say, Penny Dreadful and... Hey, that already has Dorian Gray as a character.
Yeah, I mean, Penny Dreadful is basically kind of...
It's a little bit darker than how you want the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but still really fucking fun.
Oh, yeah, I mean, but there are dark aspects of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, how many episodes of Penny Dreadful have you seen?
Two.
Oh, did you see the second one? Did you see Seance?
I think so, I don't know.
Did it have a seance in it?
Maybe. Maybe I only saw the... I thought I saw two, but maybe I only saw the first one.
You would remember the seance.
Okay.
Because it's horrifying.
Okay. Anyway. So, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen would be a hard one, too, I would think. So I think my answers would be Fables and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
And I think that Jordan took the answer with Preacher, really, but... Oh, God. Oh, this one just hit me. I have no idea why I didn't think of this first. Transmetropolitan.
Oh, yeah, Transmetropolitan would be hard.
Yeah, that one... Like, I'm trying to think of where you would fucking begin with that.
You need to be, like something akin to, like, Cloud Atlas, kind of.
You need... In really
the future sense.
Like, you would need really experimental directors being channeled by... really experimental writers channeled by really professional directors who know how to make things work and do it on something that really wants to have no rules and show off how little rules it has, like, say, Netflix.
Yeah.
And, like, that's the only way I could see Transmetropolitan working.
Yeah. All right, then.
That's it.
That's it. So, I believe that answers all of our questions. Thank you again, everybody, for sending in those questions for us to answer. And I believe that wraps up this episode, Casey.
Okay.
Okay. Bye, guys.
I don't know. We'll see you next week, and then it'll be my turn to rule the show.
I'm going to edit that out.
Oh, okay.
Keep starting, everybody.